It's Monday, the 30th of April, 2012. This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Iti Agnihotri Madholkar. Support for KUAF comes from the Rogers Historical Museum and Portraits in Grey, a Civil War photography exhibition featuring the collection of David Wynne Vaughan. This traveling exhibit runs through July 21st and illustrates the importance of photographers and photographs of the period. 621-1154 or rogersarkansas.com/museum for more information. On this edition of Ozarks, Walmart launches several programs around the world under its Global Women's Economic Empowerment Initiative. And on May 19th, Fayetteville's Dixon Street will literally go to the dogs. Also on the show today, author Jeffrey Olsner talks about his non-ordinary experiences. But first, these items of note. The Arkansas Tech University Ozark campus has received an approval from the Department of Higher Education for an Associate of General Studies degree. The approval will enable students to adapt their coursework to meet industry needs as well as transition into four-year degree programs. Arkansas Tech received the approval this past Friday during the Department of Higher Ed Coordinating Board's quarterly meeting. For more information about the Associate of General Studies degree at Arkansas Tech University Ozark campus, 667-2117. Last week, Tyson Foods unveiled its new special mobile feeding unit to help disaster relief efforts. The 53-foot semi-trailer will be the central supply unit at disaster-struck sites to support the company's relief efforts, dubbed as Meals That Matter. The multinational food manufacturer has provided food in disaster-stricken areas in and near its plants in 26 states for decades. Supplemented with mobile grills supplied by Tyson's plant locations, the unit is fully equipped to set up and run a cooking site, including refrigeration, tents and lights, sanitation equipment, and even a Wi-Fi hotspot via satellite. In the event of a disaster, Tyson Cook teams and volunteers help cook and feed people in need and relief workers. Earlier this year, Tyson also agreed to partner with American Red Cross during future disaster relief efforts. The University of Arkansas softball team closed out its 2012 home season with a 5-1 loss to Alabama. The Razorbacks' overall record is 25-24 for the season and 6-19 in the Southeastern Conference. Wednesday, the Razorbacks traveled to Missouri State to play their last non-conference game of the regular season. The University of Arkansas baseball team, ranked number 21 in the nation, defeated 5th-ranked Florida 3-1 yesterday when the Razorbacks broke a 1-1 tie with a pair of runs in the top of the 10th. The victory clinched the series for the Razorbacks and improved the team's record to 31-13 overall and 11-10 in SEC play. The series win for Arkansas was just the third for the Razorbacks in Gainesville and the first since the 2008 season. Arkansas is back in action tomorrow as it hosts Missouri in the first game of an 8-game homestand. The Razorbacks and Tigers will meet at 6:35 tomorrow evening. And the Northwest Arkansas Naturals had their 6-game win streak snapped yesterday at Harvest Ballpark with a 9-3 loss to the Arkansas Travelers. The series and 8-game homestand wraps up today with a game that is currently in progress. Tomorrow, the Naturals will head to Springfield for a 4-game series against the Cardinals. First pitch is scheduled for 7:08 tomorrow evening. This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Iti Agnihotri Madhokar. Last fall, Walmart announced the formation of an initiative that will use the company's global size and presence to empower women. The Walmart Global Women's Economic Empowerment Initiative seeks to leverage the supply chain and the jobs the retailer has to offer to strengthen women around the world. Sarah Thorne is the Senior Director of Walmart Corporate Affairs and one of the leads for the global initiative.
We have set some very ambitious goals, but I think it's very important to realize that this is about helping women through our business practices. So in terms of sourcing, training, and helping leverage our professional services to advance women around the globe.
Thorne says the initiative had been in the works for at least a year before it was launched. According to the data available on the Walmart corporate website, the retailer spent more than $10 billion with minority and women-owned businesses in 2010, of which $8 billion were spent purchasing goods and services used for manufacturing products. According to Thorne, the initiative has five goals focusing on two main areas: increasing sourcing from women-owned businesses and job training and education.
We've pledged to train about 500,000 women farmers in good agricultural practices over the next 5 years, and then training in factories related to life skills and work skills and communication to make them a much more valuable part of the factory and in their communities. And then finally, several years ago, we launched a program in the legal department to make sure that we had very good gender and minority diversity among the firms that were serving Walmart.
Earlier this month, Walmart took the first step in the direction of implementing these goals by launching the Women in Factories program in India, Bangladesh, China, and Central America. Meredith Minhenet is a senior manager with Walmart Ethical Sourcing.
The Women in Factories program specifically will help 60,000 women and will potentially create new opportunities for career advancement for 8,000 women who live in countries where often the predominant population on the factory floor is comprised of women, but we don't often see a lot of upward movement in terms of promotion to supervisory positions.
Minhenet says the five-year program has taken an innovative approach to improving lives of women in factories.
We're bringing together multiple NGOs to design the program as well as to implement the program. It's been a very collaborative process. The other innovative portion is that the ownership of the program is really in the local communities as well as in the factories where the program is based. This has always been a program that we've seen that needs to be owned at the women, the women's level as well as the factories level for it to be sustained.
Walmart is also working with CARE, an international nonprofit organization fighting global poverty, to develop a curriculum for the program. This curriculum will be open sourced and the findings will be shared with other retailers and corporate giants to empower even more women. Melanie Mintz, Senior Director with CARE's Strategic Partnerships and Alliances, says CARE's partnership with Walmart and other retailers is helping women learn more about their civil and legal rights and needs. She cites an example about rural women who moved to Dhaka, the capital of Bangladesh, to find work.
We're giving women critical skills around literacy and numeracy. We're working with women so that they understand basic finance. Can they calculate the overtime on their check and then make sure that that's correct? To know that they're being paid what they earned? We're teaching them about proper health and nutrition. And they're taking those lessons and then obviously not only benefiting themselves directly, that goes right back into the community and into their families. We're also teaching women, and through this program with Walmart, around legal rights. So around things as basic as maternity leave or divorce law. And then we're connecting those women to services within the DACA communities that they just might not have known existed.
CARE is also teaching these women mentorship skills to help them uplift their peers. The nonprofit is involving men in the communities to support and empower women around them. Aside from women in factories, Walmart has also announced the launch of two new programs in Latin America and the Caribbean. The first is called the New Employment Opportunities, or the NEO Initiative. Launched in partnership with other corporate giants such as McDonald's and Caterpillar, it hopes to provide job training and placement to approximately 1 million young people, half of which are young women. Sarah Thorne, Senior Director of Walmart Corporate Affairs.
The NEO Initiative really is a partnership with the Inter-American Development Bank, or the IDB, major businesses in the hemisphere, as well as leading nonprofits in training. What we recognized is there's an enormous youth bulge in the Americas, that is, youth that are somewhat disenfranchised, that don't have good job prospects. And what we wanted to do was to figure out what's the best way to bring all of these assets together, the businesses, the governments, and the NGOs, to provide training, real training for the youth that can give them good life skills as well as technical skills so that they can get those first jobs.
The initiative is modeled after Walmart's Brazil social retail school curriculum that has shown success in placing the school's graduates in suitable jobs. Another program launched to benefit women business owners in Latin America and the Caribbean is the Women Entrepreneurship America Small Grants Initiative, says Thorne.
We know that women entrepreneurs face a number of challenges, such as access to finance, peer networks. So if you've never seen other women growing their businesses, how do you know how to grow your business? How do you know what to aspire to? Training. So how do you make sure people know appropriately what kind of packaging, et cetera? And we partnered with the State Department to launch a comprehensive program in the Americas to try to start to address these challenges.
Walmart will contribute to the initiative in two ways.
Part of it is a $1.5 million donation grant to the State Department that will work with the Secretary's Fund for Women and Girls to create grants outside of urban areas to help create an atmosphere and infrastructure for women entrepreneurs to thrive by helping nonprofit organizations work on those very skills that they need. We're also working with Vital Voices to train women entrepreneurs in the hemisphere. And we're working with a group called WeConnect, which helps to identify and certify women-owned businesses. So from our part, this will help us identify the women, and it'll help them get the necessary training they need so that they can hopefully be part of the formal supply chain.
The retailer has launched similar programs for women entrepreneurs in the United States. For example, a program called Count Me In identifies small women-owned businesses that have the potential to scale up. Another program called A Hand to Grow is a small business development program that helps provide technical training and understanding of how to become a Walmart supplier. Thorne says the various programs and the Global Women's Economic Empowerment Initiative benefits Walmart in a number of ways.
We know that women control the majority of consumer spend worldwide, and we want to be a relevant retailer to those women. So by sourcing more for women-owned businesses, we can have very relevant products for our shoppers, our moms who come into our stores. We also know that women invest in their communities. So by helping women at the level of the farm and the factories, we know that we'll create more healthy communities, strengthen those communities, and then thereby, by being the retailer in those communities, we'll be more successful over the long run.
When asked about the allegations of gender-based discrimination in matters of hiring and promotion that the retailer has faced in the past, Walmart spokesperson Philip Keen said the allegations that were eventually overturned by the U.S. Supreme Court have never represented the company's policies. He said Walmart has ample opportunities for female associates to move up within the company, adding that nearly 200,000 female associates have been with the company for more than 10 years. This is Ozarks at Large. If you've been wondering about the latest in business and political news in the state, look no further. Roby Brock from our content partner TalkBusiness.net is back with another roundup of the latest in Arkansas business and politics.
I'm Roby Brock with your Talk Business Update, a recap of the biggest business and political headlines of the last week. Grant Tenniel, director of the Arkansas Economic Development Commission, says he's already building on Governor Mike Beebe's trade trip to China. Tenniel, who was permanently appointed to the AEDC post in late March, said follow-up to the Chinese trade mission will include diligent pursuit of discussions from the 12-day trip. Allegations of bribery, international corruption, and a sloppy corporate cover-up at Walmart stores have hammered the retail giant's share price and reputation. Analysts are mixed about the potential fallout, which could unfold in the coming days as more is known about the bribery scandal under the watch of Eduardo Castro Wright, who is credited for an amazing run in expanding the company's Mexican business segment. A New York Times article earlier in the week detailed allegations that top Walmart executives knew of a bribery scheme in Mexico that allowed for accelerated expansion in that country. The article states that Walmart officials did not disclose the potential violations of the Foreign Corruption Practices Act as required by law. Federal regulators in the U.S. and Mexico are investigating the allegations. Highlighting a number of unusual items, trucking giant Arkansas Best swung to an $18.2 million first quarter loss despite a modest revenue gain. The Fort Smith trucking firm reported the loss on revenue of $440.8 million. 1 year ago, Arkansas Best lost $12.8 million on revenue of $435 million. PAM Transportation Services returned to the black after several disappointing quarters of net losses. And the Taneytown trucking firm reported its first positive first quarter of earnings in 5 years. Deltic Timber squeaked out a small first quarter profit of $97,000 despite a tough but improving real estate environment. In politics, our latest Talk Business Hendricks College poll showed that First District Democrats are far from decided on a nominee to challenge incumbent Republican Congressman Rick Crawford. In a head-to-head matchup of the three Democratic candidates running for the 1st District congressional seat, Jonesboro prosecutor Scott Ellington pulled 15%, State Representative Clark Hall of Marvel pulled 10%, and Gary Latonich, an ASU economics professor, registered at 3.5%. That leaves 71.5% of the voters in the 1st District with an undecided opinion. I'm Roby Brock, and that is your Talk Business Update.
We all have heard of pub crawls, but the month of May will see a pub crawl come to life in Fayetteville. The city's animal shelter is hosting the first ever Dixon Street pub crawl Saturday, May 19th between 3 and 6 p.m. to bring the region's dog lovers together. I spoke with Justine Middleton, Animal Services Superintendent for the City of Fayetteville, to find out more.
Well, it's an event that came about just by having a meeting with a group of volunteers, and we was back probably in February, and we were planning out the special events for the shelter this year, and they were really interested in doing some new events, new fundraisers, and we just started talking about things we like and who doesn't like Dixon Street and their dog, and it just kind of came out of that, and we're really excited about it. We think it's going to be a lot of fun.
So this is the first time that you're doing a pup crawl?
Yes.
So how many such events do you do in a year to take the dogs out or, you know, some event where the citizens can see these adoptable animals?
Well, we try to get our pets out as much as possible because we are kind of stuck down in one end of Fayetteville. A lot of people maybe don't know where we are. A lot of people maybe don't like the idea of coming to the shelter. So our volunteers work really hard, and so does our staff, to try to get pets to different events. And we get invited to multiple events throughout the year. And then we also look for new opportunities to get our pets out. Obviously, Farmers Market is one of our biggest venues that we're at pretty much every Saturday that it happens. But we also do different events at PetSmart, at lots of local businesses. We get a lot of local businesses that maybe want to drive some foot traffic through their store, and having pets is a really great way to do that. So we're always, you know, willing to go try new stuff.
Do we have any statistics of how many dogs or cats get adopted after they were taken to these events?
I think that it definitely increases a pet's chances of getting adopted. I know that last year, I think we adopted out probably about between 300 and 500 animals from just off-site adoption events. And that's with people never even having, you know, they only come to the shelter just to pick up their animal after it's been spayed or neutered. So
about one-fifth or one-fourth of these animals are adopted with the help of these events that are...
Yes, and it's also really interesting, too, because it's kind of hard to track sometimes. Someone might see a dog at Farmer's Market or see a cat at PetSmart, right. And maybe they don't make the decision then, but they come in, you know, on Monday or Tuesday later after the event, and then they find either that pet or another pet that they like. So,
okay. Now, so how many of these events are put together by the shelter? And who helps put together these events? Is it always the shelter employees or also volunteers?
It's definitely a collaborative effort as far as like organizing the events and fielding a lot of questions. Usually it's shelter staff that might set up the coordinating part on the front end, but it's pretty much primarily volunteer driven as far as getting the animals out of the shelter into events. So it's something that is really amazing to see so many people in the community that want to come down and help get these pets a home. And we couldn't do it without volunteers. There's just no way.
Could you talk about some events that happened in the last year that, you know, were successful and helped get the word out?
Well, we did a couple of new events last year where we had been reading online about different kinds of programs where you just have maybe fee-waived events or almost like specials on your adoption fees.
Right.
We did a free cat Friday last year in June, and we adopted out every single available cat in the shelter in
really?
One day. It was crazy. But it was really exciting, too.
Yes.
I mean, I think it was like 63 cats in one day. It came at a really good time of year for us, too, because that's a really busy time. And then since we had such success with that, we did a correlating event for the dogs later in the summer called the Dog Day of Summer. And we adopted out, I think, about 75 dogs in one day.
Wow.
It was, and that also we could not have done without volunteers because even if I had pretty much most of my staff there, but there's no way you can help that. But we had people. We had one person that slept out in their car all night so they could have their first choice because we didn't let people choose ahead of time. You know, we wanted to be as fair about it as possible. And
right.
You never know how things like that are going to go until you do them. But those are two that stick out in my mind that were really different and really exciting for us that we did last year.
Okay. So what happens during pup crawl? When is it? All the details. Where is it? How do people get involved? How do people contribute?
Yeah. Well, the actual event is on May 19th, and it starts at 3 p.m. People will check in at Kingfish Bar down on right off Dixon, and they're also going to host the after party for us. But you'll come, you'll check in, you'll get your t-shirt, your dog will get a bandana. The logo for this event is adorable. And then we'll just set you on your way. There's 8 participating bars, and you're welcome to take your dog into these bars for this amount of time, and they'll have really great drink specials. You'll get to meet people. Definitely, if you're interested in volunteering, just give the shelter a call. We would love to have more volunteers. We definitely want to make this event as smooth as possible. We've never done it before, so we're really excited, but definitely want to keep things, you know, under control. But we're just hoping that it's a really good time for people, you know, that love their pets, they love to socialize, they want to get out, meet new people, have some fun. This is a great way to do that while raising money for the shelter.
Do we know which bars are participating?
Mm-hmm. There is, I don't know if I'll remember them all, but there's Kingfish, Rogue, Brewskies, Grubb's Patio, Speakeasy, Dixon Street Pub. I think that's most of them.
Okay.
And Infusion. I think that's all of them. I think I maybe remembered all
okay.
of them.
So. And it starts at?
It starts at 3 p.m. Okay. and it ends up at 6 p.m. And after that, we have an optional after party for an extra $5. You can come. We're going to have live music and catering from the Flying Burrito at Kingfish.
How can you find more information about this event?
Well, we have it on Facebook. So if you search on Facebook for Dixon Street Pup Crawl, you'll find it there. You'll also find a link where you can register online, or you can come by the shelter and register anytime we're open.
Is there a fee to participate?
Mm-hmm. It is a fundraiser, so it's a $25 fee, and that will get you a t-shirt for yourself and a bandana for your dog and just access to all the bars.
Okay, so it will be a super happy hour.
Yes, exactly.
Thank you so much, Justine.
Oh, you're welcome. Thank you for having me.
The first ever Dixon Street Pup Crawl will be hosted Saturday, May 19th between 3 and 6 p.m. to benefit the Fayetteville Animal Shelter. The registration fee for the event is $25 per dog and includes a t-shirt, a dog bandana, and drink specials. The deadline to register is today. To find links for pre-registration and more information, you can log on to ozarksatlarge.com.
I'm Stephen Cook. On April 19, 2012, Phillips County native Levon Helm lost his long battle with cancer. The impact of his death, as with his life, has been felt and acknowledged around the world. This week, we revisit an episode of Arkansongs honoring the life and vast legacy of our fellow Arkansasier, who is undeniably one of the most important figures of his musical generation.
Oh, the poor old dirt farmer, he's lost all his corn. And now where's the money to pay off his loan? He lost all his corn, can't pay off his loan.
Whether as a member of Ronnie Hawkins's Hawks or of Rock and Roll Hall of Famers The Band, Levon Helm has been at the fore of American rock for decades. From the time when the original band broke up in the late 1970s to when the band reformed without original guitarist Robbie Robertson a decade later, Helm released four solo albums. Helm's solo albums also have been showcases of such talents as Dr. John, Steve Cropper, and Booker T. Jones, and such Arkansas-connected performers as Henry Glover and the Cate Brothers. The October 30th, 2007 release of Dirt Farmer marks 25 years since Helm's last solo venture. It's also his first since his 1998 throat surgery, nearly 30 radiation treatments, and beating throat cancer, and regaining much of his distinctive singing voice. The near loss by fire to the studio barn pictured on his 1977 debut solo album, and the death of longtime bandmate Rick Danko in December 1999, added to what Helm admits was a hard period of his life.
And a poor old dirt farmer, he's a left all alone.
There are a few ringers, but Levon Helm's Dirt Farmer isn't a huge star-studded event. His daughter, Amy Helm, co-produces with guitarist and fiddle player Larry Campbell. Campbell is best known for his years with Bob Dylan. Levon credits Amy in encouraging him to record some of the songs he grew up singing with his family in rural Phillips County, parents Nell and Diamond Helm, brother Wheeler, and sisters Modena and Linda.
Oh, listen now, children, a story I'll tell of a woman
Anna Amston, who grew up with Levon Helm in Phillips County, will be forever known to fans of the band as young Anna Lee from the band's likely most famous song, The Wait, from 1968. Long a friend of musicians and known for her Arkansas cooking, Amston came out with her own cookbook in fall 2007. She gets a nod from Helm on the album Dirt Farmer with the song Anna Lee, heard here.
Return to you, dreaming with each lullaby. Hold your sweet, weary head to my breast.
Helm says this song, Single Girl, Married Girl, by A.P. Carter of the Carter Family, became one of his favorites from the sessions. Although Helm's album is stripped down, with traditional songs arranged by Levon or Amy or Larry Campbell, half of the record does feature drums. Not surprising considering it's a Levon-Helm record, but the world's most famous drummer from Turkey Scratch, Arkansas, does cede the drummer's throne to his daughter Amy on two songs. She also plays mandolin and piano on the album. Levon also plays mandolin and acoustic guitar. Down-home takes on more contemporary songwriters are also found on the album Dirt Farmer. A Steve Earle song appears, as does one by Byron Isaacs, who also plays bass on several songs on the album. Anna Lee, heard earlier, is by Birmingham, Alabama songwriter Laura Lynn Dossett. Heard next is Dirt Farmer's Closer, a song by Buddy and Julie Miller called Wide River to Cross.
There's a sorrow in the wind, blowing down the road I've been. I can hear it cry while shadows steal the sun. But I cannot look back now. I've come too far to turn around, and there's still a race ahead. Journey on.
With all its family ties and Arkansas ties, Levon Helm's Dirt Farmer is surely his most personal solo album. It also may be his strongest. Here in its entirety is Levon Helm of Turkey Scratch in Phillips County with Steve Earle's song, The Mountain, from Helm's 2007 album, Dirt Farmer.
I was born on this mountain a long, long time ago, before they knocked down the timber and a strip mined all the coal. When you rose up in the morning before it was daylight, you go down in that dark hole and come back up at night. I was born on this mountain, this mountain's my home. She holds me and she keeps me from a worry and a woe. Well, they took everything she gave, and now she's
Levon Helm of Turkey Scratch in Phillips County with The Mountain from his 2007 album Dirt Farmer on Vanguard Records, written by Steve Earle. It's another song of Arkansas. From Little Rock, I'm Stephen Cook with Arkansongs.
Arkansongs is a production of FM 89 and Experiment Station Studios. For more information, visit arkansongs.org.
It's Monday, the 30th of April, 2012. This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Iti Agnihotri Matholkar, and with me is Becca Martin-Brown, features editor with Northwest Arkansas Newspapers.
If we had a few more names, we could make some new people. Ending today at the Springdale Public Library, Visions of the Universe, a celebration of astronomy, beautiful images. Run over there.
Okay.
Also through May 5th at the Bentonville Public Library, Master Architect, Master Builder, an exhibit about Faye Jones and Truman Bowling.
Okay.
The UA Concert Band performs tonight, as does the UA Wind Symphony, starting at 7:30 at the Walton Arts Center in Fayetteville. Tickets are $10 for adults. And a band called EOTO, originally a side project of the String Cheese Incident,
String cheese incident?
Yes.
Okay.
Kevin needs to be here to tell us these things. It's electronica. They perform tonight at George's at 9 o'clock, and it's $12. If Kevin says go there, I believe him. So go there.
And EOTO stands for something?
Beats me.
Okay.
Something that goes with string cheese, I guess.
Thanks, Becca. Becca Martin Brown is the features editor with Northwest Arkansas Newspapers.
Jeffrey Olsner is a poet, a singer-songwriter, a psychotherapist, and a longtime Fayetteville native. His latest book, A Country Where All Colors Are Sacred and Alive, a memoir of non-ordinary experience and collaboration with nature, talks about his parapsychological experiences and spiritual journey. He visited KUAF's Anthony and Susan Y. News Studio recently to talk with Ozarks at Large's Kyle Kellums about the book and how he came to recognize the subtle, non-ordinary events in his life.
How would you define non-ordinary experience?
Almost synonymously with parapsychological or extrasensory, I would say.
When did you start cataloging some of these non-ordinary experiences?
All right. Well, what happened with me was that these things always were interesting to me. I was the kind of kid who loved reading Ripley's Believe It or Not and Frank Edwards' Truth is Stranger Than Fiction books. And I just have never really ever left from that interest. But in, oh, a couple of years back, the Unitarian Church here asked me to do a sermon. And I came up with a sermon called Sacred Exchanges with Nature. And it was really based on a premise that I'd been exploring for years and read some research about, that things like prayer and blessing and just our love and affection for our gardens, any aspect of nature, actually has the potential of having some kind of positive effect, say, on the growth of plants. There's a book called The Secret Life of Plants that some people remember that shares some of that research. And so in the course of doing this sermon for the Unitarians, I decided, and it felt like a little risk, that I would share a couple of experiences I'd had which were distinctly non-ordinary and really got my attention. And I was surprised to see that the Unitarians seemed interested. And I got to thinking afterwards, how many experiences have I had where, like these two that I'm mentioning, someone else witnessed what was going on, or there was some sort of confirmation afterwards, such as you might find if you had a precognitive dream that came true. And I began to journal in the mornings as I remembered things, and some of you will know what it's like when you start to prime the pump of memory, other things, other associations begin to flow. And to my surprise, something like 70 or 80 different recollections came to me. Not all of them quite as confirmatory as the best ones, but generally having some kind of element of extraordinary synchronicity or just outright pointing to some kind of capacities that human beings have to move outside of what we normally think of as our ability to understand things through our senses into a larger dimension of awareness.
You write about some of those precognitive dreams and also about your first house in Fayetteville where there right. might have been some events.
Might have been, yeah. So what we noticed there, we were living adjacent to an old farmstead, and it had been sectioned off, but originally had been a 400-acre place. And there had been a lot of activity around that place for a long time, since pre-Civil War. And we noticed that in our house there seemed to be an extra presence. We'd see it peripherally. I saw it and didn't report it, and a young woman who was a boarder in our home at that time also noticed it and reported it independently. And there were other instances which I can't vouch for as clearly, but what happened with this presence in the home was that one night I went downstairs to get a snack, and I saw this ghostly presence. It was very distinct. It was purple and floating. And heaven knows how many times I've heard reports of ghosts in Great Britain, where it was associated with a figure coming down a stairway. I don't know why that is, but it's interesting. This was similar. The figure was at the top of the stairway. And I was scared. I have been a practicing Buddhist for some time. So the thing I knew to do would be to try out a mantra and to say it with an intention for the liberation or the peace of this apparently unquiet, kind of unhappy and restless spirit. I walked through this presence, this strange thing with this mantra, and went down, got my snack, came upstairs. The stairway was phantom-free as far as I could tell, and I went back into the bedroom. And my wife was half awake, and the window was half open. There was a screen. And she said, "Oh, what was that? It looked like a black moth, but it flew out through the screen. How could that be?" This was no prior information about my strange experience on the stairway. We never saw that face peripherally again.
Some of the anecdotes that you relate in the book, and we should say the book is titled A Country Where All Colors Are Sacred and Alive. Some of the anecdotes, you mentioned that you're with someone who is, and you painstakingly point out, perhaps not as tuned in or as ready to accept non-ordinary events.
Sure.
I think that's interesting.
And maybe I was that person in certain situations too. I think it's interesting too, and I think that when I grew up in Kansas City, I was pretty much surrounded by people who, for them, as part of their evolution, it was important for them to disavow traditional organized religion. They had a good look during World War II at what different manifestations of nationalism and belief caused and cost, and they wanted to move beyond different kinds of sectarian views. And they pretty much threw what I would say is the beautiful, unconditioned baby of spirituality out with the bathwater, the historically murky bathwater of religiosity. Although there's great beauty in religion, these folks really just rejected the whole thing and didn't consider anything possible other than what we take in with our senses, which is certainly a view that I respect. And I saw these people as very kind and good people. But as I was growing up, I started spontaneously having things happen to me that couldn't be fit into that box.
I read this as, this is what's happened to me. This is what I thought about it. And if 700 people read this tomorrow, you might have 700 different interpretations people that come away.
Really, whether it's a book or a radio broadcast for that matter, I'm sure that there are going to be people that embrace what's heard or read, and there are going to be people that really are neutral, and there sure are going to be people who encounter this material and feel negative about it. So it's to my advantage not to be overly didactic, but it's also to my personal advantage not to be too sure I'm right about any of this, because my goodness, if any of this points towards anything, it's to a larger perspective than many of us have considered, and I'm sure it's much larger than I'm aware of.
When I was reading this, I began realizing, gosh, there just aren't that many non-ordinary events in my life.
Yeah.
Or, I mean, you know, some people, flat out, I'm a skeptic of everything.
Okay.
But at the same time, I don't doubt any of these things happened. Or where does that leave people like me?
Well, I don't know. I think you could certainly doubt my interpretation of these things and know that I perceived them. But it's especially impressive to me when somebody else was right there with me and perceived them, and I'm able to report that. I don't know where it leaves any of us, although I think we're each one of us at a disadvantage if we close down our account on reality and don't pay attention. And so, you know, I may be at a disadvantage too at a given moment when I'm not paying attention, and maybe what I need to pay attention to is distinctly non-ordinary, but very much what's right in front of me.
Or maybe I should step back and maybe I've had some non-ordinary things and whizzed past them. When I've talked to you before, it's mostly been about your poetry.
Yeah.
Do you think the attempt to try to observe more, to take in more, helps you in writing poetry?
I think so. And I think some of my poems are an attempt to share some of these distinctly unusual events while, I'm going to say, in a sense, hiding as well as advancing behind a metaphorical shield. I don't think I've ever tried to be as clear and explicit and claim these things in the way that I've done in this book. So poetry has helped me to observe, but at the same time, it's allowed me to stay in the realm of that which is poetic and not necessarily literally to be taken as true.
You write about something in this book, and if you don't want to talk about this,
okay,
it's fine. But you mention your friend John Locke, who, of course, was a professor on the University of Arkansas campus, tragically killed on campus. And you mentioned that you called to his office.
I can't account for this. I called John, and I hadn't called him for, I'm sure, months. We were friends, but not terribly close. And I felt a sudden urge to call him, and when I did, there'd already been the student was holed up in the office with John, and I heard a shot while I was on the phone. I don't think that was the shot that killed him, but there were three, I think.
It is hard to merely dismiss that you wanted to call him when you hadn't called him or you didn't call him often.
Yeah, it's interesting. It's not something that can be pointed to as proof of any kind of foreknowledge, but I think it would make sense to neither accept it or reject it out of hand.
I think that's what your book does. To me, it doesn't necessarily accept nor reject anything. It says, consider.
Good. I want that.
We should mention you'll be reading from and signing copies of the book.
Yes, thanks. At Nightbird Books on Saturday, May the 5th at 7 p.m. And then in the Walker Room at the Fayetteville Public Library on May the 22nd, which I think is a Tuesday, at 6:45 p.m., I'll be doing another reading. And in both cases, Kyle, as time allows, I will invite people to share some of the things that come up for them as they hear these stories. And there may be things that are brought up, and it would be a lot of fun to do something more participatory. So that's what I'll be doing.
Thank you so much for your time. Congratulations on the book.
Thanks so much.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Monday. It's the 30th of April, 2012. It was on this date, 1859, Charles Dickens's A Tale of Two Cities was first published. It came out in serial form in a new weekly magazine all the year round, which Dickens himself had founded. And A Tale of Two Cities was on the front page of the first issue. Thanks to his popularity, the first issue sold 125,000 copies. The magazine was successful from the start. Dickens's investment paid off, and he serialized Great Expectations in the magazine 1 year later. A Tale of Two Cities, which begins, "It was the best of times, it was the worst of times. It was the age of wisdom, it was the age of foolishness. It was the epoch of belief, it was the epoch of incredulity. It was the season of light, it was the season of darkness. It was the spring of hope, it was the winter of despair. We had everything before us, we had nothing before us. We were all going direct to heaven, we were all going direct the other way." It's the birthday of Annie Dillard, born in Pittsburgh, 1945. She wrote her master's thesis on Thoreau's Walden. Then she moved to a cabin in the Blue Ridge Mountains and kept a daily journal of her observations of nature, her thoughts about religion, wrote in old notebooks and on 4x6-inch index cards. And her book, Pilgrim at Tinker Creek, published in 1974, won the Pulitzer Prize for nonfiction. She was only 29 years old. Her most recent work is a novel, The May Trees. And it was on this date in 1952 Anne Frank's diary was first published in English, Diary of a Young Girl. Came out in Dutch, 1947, under the title The Secret Annex. Anne Frank died of typhus in the Bergen-Belsen concentration camp about 2 weeks before the camps were liberated in 1945. After the war, her father, Otto Frank, was given the diary. He wasn't able to read it for a while. It was too painful. but when he did, he saw that his daughter meant for the diary to be published. There were two versions of the diary, the A version, made up of journal entries, and the B version, rewritten by Anne herself. Her father edited the two together. He left out 5 pages of her original A version, pages in which she described the progress of her sexual development and ranted about her mother. Those pages were restored in the definitive edition, which was published in 1995. Here's our poem for today, which is an excerpt from Anne Frank's diary for Wednesday, February 23, 1944. As long as this exists, I thought, and I may live to see it, the sunshine, the cloudless skies, while this lasts, I cannot be unhappy. The best remedy for those who are afraid, lonely, or unhappy is to go outside, somewhere where they can be quite alone with the heavens, nature, and God, because only then does one feel that all is as it should be, and that God wishes to see people happy amidst the simple beauty of nature. As long as this exists, and it certainly always will, I know that then there will always be comfort for every sorrow, whatever the circumstances may be, and I firmly believe that nature brings solace in all troubles. From Anne Frank, The Diary of a Young Girl, published by Bantam Books and used by permission here on the Writer's Almanac, supported by Constant Contact, now offering social campaigns, a new tool designed to help small businesses turn fans into customers. Learn more at constantcontact.com. And by reputation.com, offering patented protection for the online reputations of professionals and businesses, now including reputation assessments. Learn more at reputation.com. Produced by Kathy Roach, written by Holly Vanderhaar. Be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
Support for KUAF is provided by contributing listeners and by Northwest Arkansas Business Journal, featuring young professionals, the Fast 15 and networking events, plus other local business news in Northwest Arkansas. The current edition is available at 725-0394 or nwabusinessjournal.com to register for daily business e-news or for more information. Support for KUAF also comes from Northwest Arkansas Media, publishers of Northwest Arkansas Times, Springdale and Rogers Morning News, Benton County Daily Record, and the Northwest Arkansas edition of the Arkansas Democrat Gazette, offering dedicated and comprehensive election coverage at nwavote.com and a political, business, and entertainment blog online at nwasource.com. KUAF is proud to co-sponsor Walton Arts Center's Artosphere, Arkansas's Arts and Nature Festival running May 3rd through June 22nd. The opening weekend includes live music at Bentonville's First Friday and the Trail Mix concert tour in both Fayetteville and Bentonville. Information and an event schedule available at artosphearfestival.org. This is KUAF 91.3 FM, Fayetteville, Springdale, Rogers, Tontitown, Bella Vista. Week.